Our first reading today came from the book of Jeremiah, and I must say that the book of Jeremiah is one of the more fascinating books in the Bible to read. Now, usually when you hear me say something like that, you usually hear me also suggest that you might want to try reading it to discover this to be the case. But even though that would be cool, I'm not trying to lay that on you. You see, Jeremiah is the longest book in the Bible. A lot of times people think the Psalms is the longest book because it has 150 chapters in it, but those chapters are actually individual songs in a hymn book. When you actually count up the number of words, Jeremiah has the book of Psalms beat. So it's the longest book in the Bible, but that's not what really makes it fascinating, what makes it interesting. There's a couple of other things that make it interesting. One of them is that when you read the book, and it begins with the call of Jeremiah, which we read in the scriptures this morning, and then it covers a period of 40 years when Jeremiah was a prophet to Israel. Well, to the southern kingdom of Judah. You see, the nation had split into two, and about 100 or so years earlier, the northern kingdom of Israel had been put into exile, and now it's the kingdom of Judah. But this is where Jerusalem is, the centerpiece of the Israelites as a whole. So for 40 years, Jeremiah is speaking to them. And as you read the book of Jeremiah, what you discover is that it's actually not written in chronological order. You kind of read for a little bit from the beginning, then you skip ahead to something that was over here and then skip back, and it goes back and forth, and it can be really weird and confusing. And if you try to unravel it and sort it out, you end up having a bit of a task ahead of you. Now, you can do that, but there's a reason why it wasn't written that way. It wasn't a mistake. The intention was, rather than simply giving a chronicle of everything that happened in Jeremiah's life in this period of time, instead it was meant to highlight the themes of what it is that he had to say. You heard in the reading this morning that he was called by God to be a prophet to Israel, a prophet to the nations even, that God would give him the words of God to share and to speak and to proclaim. And so what it is that Jeremiah had to say becomes the focus on what is going on in the book of Jeremiah as a whole. So it's arranged thematically. But another interesting thing that makes this book fascinating is that it also gives us a rather interesting look into the person of Jeremiah himself and what it is that he experiences, his calling, how it is that he goes about fulfilling this prophetic call. And we'll come back to that observation in a minute. But when you begin reading the book, you'll find in the first 25 chapters that the theme is essentially the same. Jeremiah preaches to Israel that the Babylonian Empire is coming and will destroy and defeat Jerusalem. This is not exciting news. This is not something fun to hear. People aren't happy to hear it. But nevertheless, that is what Jeremiah proclaims. And the reason he says that this is going to happen is because Israel violated the covenant of God that was established with Moses back on Mount Sinai when the Torah was given, when the Ten Commandments were given, and all of that. 1,000 years later now, Jeremiah says, you guys have been breaking the covenant, you've shattered the agreement, you've broken the contract, and so the consequences have to be meted out. The covenant all along said, if you live rightly and honor God, things will go well for you. If you do not do these things, then things are going to go horribly for you. Well, it's time now. It's going to be really bad. In fact, you will be utterly defeated. Jerusalem will be taken. The temple will be destroyed. And that's it. You're done. And again, because this wasn't an exciting piece of news to share, people weren't interested in hearing it, but there was also another reason why the leaders weren't really thrilled with Jeremiah to hear this. And part of that is because of the assumption they had made about Jerusalem. Jerusalem is the holy city. Mount Zion in the middle of it is the place that God had chosen to be where God's name would be proclaimed. And it was on that location that God authorized a temple to be built. And then David's son Solomon, right? David had been promised he'll always have a descendant on the throne. His son Solomon built this temple. And when that temple was dedicated to God, it says that the presence of God came in, this cloud entered, the glory of God, the Shekinah, to use the Hebrew term, came in, and it was so pervasive, so tangible, that the priests were not able to stand to perform their duties. It made it very clear that this is God's house, God lives here. And so in all the years after that, 400 or 500 years-ish after that, The people of Israel are going, Jerusalem can't be taken. I mean, this is where God lives. God's not going to let his house get destroyed. So we have nothing to worry about. I mean, let's figure this out, Jeremiah. Look, you're talking about this bad thing going to happen because we haven't been following the covenant of God and that we're going to actually see the temple destroyed. But come on, let's get real, all right? This talk about the covenant, yeah, we know the covenant is there, but look at it. It's been 1,000 years. And even over the last 500 years, for all the kings that we've had, yeah, we've had a few kings that are all hung up on keeping the covenant and all of that, but the majority of them weren't that hung up on it. We just kind of made a go of it as we did, and life was fine, and we were good. Like, it's been good. We haven't had any big consequence, really, for not following the covenant. So I think you're overreacting a little bit. And then, because God lives here, God's never going to let his house get destroyed. You see, what had happened over this period of time is the patience and long-suffering nature of God was being ignored by the people. And they were taking it simply as reason to believe that you don't have to take the covenant that seriously. And then because they were so convinced that the temple could not be destroyed, they inadvertently ended up making an idol out of it and being convinced that the place itself was all that mattered because after all, God was there. But here's the thing, God isn't limited in that way. I mean, the Apostle Paul will say that later to the Athenians in Acts chapter 17. The God who made all things does not live in temples built by human hands. God is not served by human beings as though he needed something kind of thing. When God, at the dedication of the temple, made the presence of God felt in such a powerful way, that wasn't trying to show that God was ever limited to that building. It was an accommodation to the limited understanding that Israel was able to have. God was doing them a favor to show up in that way to make the point, look, I am with you. You are my people. I am your God. I am present. I'm in the midst of you. This is something you can count on. But it was never intended to say that God is limited to that building. And so as time progressed, and Babylon got closer and the siege began and so on, in order to help the people get over this misunderstanding, The prophet Ezekiel, who for the last 20 years of Jeremiah's ministry prophesied as well, had a vision in which that presence of God, that cloud, left the temple and headed off to the east somewhere. If Israel is going to get so focused on the idea that God lives in this place, well then, let's just show God leaving that place. And now your thought that this could never happen is gone away. Now, God didn't really leave. But he made that point. He gave that image to help Israel catch the vision about what Jeremiah was saying. So Jeremiah's ministry was not that thrilling, especially for the first 25 chapters that you read. He wasn't really popular. People opposed him, couldn't believe what it is that he had to say. But nevertheless, he continued to say it. And sure enough, as time progresses, in fact, the book of Jeremiah ends with Jerusalem being defeated. We find that that indeed is what took place. Everything that Israel had been living for, everything Israel had been counting on, was dismantled. It was destroyed and taken away. Now, because we know what happens in the pages after Jeremiah, we have a bit of an advantage because we understand that God restored them. And that actually, interestingly, is what Jeremiah was also saying. In the second half of the book, that's what he begins to proclaim. Even before the fall of Jerusalem, he begins to say, I am not going to abandon you. God says, even though you violated the covenant and this happens because of your failing, the point is I'm not going to give up on you. In fact, 70 years later, I'm going to restore you. I am not going to forget you. In fact, I know the plans I have for you, he says in Jeremiah 29. Plans not to harm you, but to prosper you, to give you hope and a future. This is being said to a people who still have yet to see the fall of Jerusalem. Now, here's the question we have to ask. If the destruction of Jerusalem was happening because Israel had broken the covenant and they finally reaped the consequences of breaking that covenant, and they're done, on what basis is God going to restore them? Why would God do so? Some people would say, well, it's because God's supposed to do that, right? God's supposed to forgive, isn't he? Well, that's an interesting observation. Where did you get that idea that God is supposed to forgive? Where is it written that God is obligated to forgive? It's actually not there. When it comes to a covenant, if the covenant is broken, the consequences of breaking the covenant are in place. The idea of forgiveness, the idea of restoration, is something that cannot come from a covenantal agreement if the covenant is broken. Instead, what Jeremiah begins to proclaim to Israel is that God will restore them despite this failing simply because of one thing: his love for them. His passionate, steadfast love for the people of God. The fact that even though they saw the cloud arrive in the temple and saw the cloud leave the temple, God actually hadn't gone anywhere. God was actually still present. And in the midst of all of this that was coming upon them rightly, nevertheless, he was going to reverse it. He was going to override the consequences. He was going to leave behind this thing that had come upon them and make it happen that they would be restored. Jeremiah points to this in the book after Jeremiah. The book of Lamentations is much shorter, and this is written by Jeremiah where he is lamenting the horrible things that are going on while Jerusalem is being attacked and falling. And in the middle of all of that, he says this: "This I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. For the Lord will not reject forever. Although he causes grief, he will have compassion according to the abundance of his steadfast love, for he does not willingly afflict or grieve anyone." God does not willingly afflict or grieve anyone. What was coming about to Israel was the necessary consequence and the justice necessary for their violation. And if we're going to say that God is obligated to do anything, we would have to say that that is that he would be just. That is why we're upset when we see injustice in the world. That's why sometimes we're tempted to be angry with God. God, why don't you do something about that injustice? We're not interested in God's forgiveness at that stage. We expect that God is obligated to deal with injustice in the world. But God's forgiveness is his merciful, gracious response out of love for people. And Israel is getting this message from the lips of Jeremiah along with that proclamation that Jerusalem would fall. Now, a fascinating piece to see this love of God is in the life of Jeremiah himself. Because as Jeremiah pleads with the people, as Jeremiah passionately tries to get this message across, as he finds himself often weeping and because of that, he's often referred to as the weeping prophet. We see God's passion for his people exemplified in Jeremiah. And even as Jeremiah is opposed for his message, thrown into prison, treated violently, left for dead in a muddy cistern, all these different things that you can read about that happened to him, it's like that's a picture of what Israel was doing to God. And yet, Jeremiah persists in this message, persists in this proclamation, and holds out this hope. The Israelites were restored. 70 years later, they were brought back into their land. The temple was able to be rebuilt. Things were brought back. They were brought back from the dead, as it were. Now, of course, not everybody witnessed that. 70 years is a long time. Jeremiah didn't get to witness the restoration of Israel. He would have passed away before that happened. But nevertheless, God's loving response to his people resulted in their restoration. Now, what does this do for us? Why does this make sense for us to read through and process and sort out? Well, let me throw this out to you. Is there any chance that you're experiencing life right now and it seems to be falling apart on you? That maybe something of life is being dismantled before your very eyes, that things are not working as they should, and maybe, just maybe, you're convinced that you know why it is, and you would say, I can tell you why, because I screwed up. I'm the one who failed. I'm the one who made the mistake. And maybe that is true. Maybe you can see things happening in your life that are falling apart because you know you made unwise decisions. You know that you made bad choices. Maybe you think that, well, that's it. God hates me now, right? I was such an idiot. How could I have done that? How is God going to? Why would God want to do anything for me? Well, the story that we see in Jeremiah is despite the reality of Israel's failing, because God is gracious, God still was with them and restored them. He'll do the same for us. That even when we mess things up, we can count on God's presence and restorative power at work. Don't ever think that God hates you. Don't ever think that God has absconded on you, that somehow he's just not there anymore. God has never gone anywhere. Maybe life is being dismantled before your very eyes and it's because of something else. It's not your fault. You can't point to anything you've done. Something else is happening to you. The Babylonians, as it were, are attacking you. Maybe that's what's going on. You know, the Amazon rainforest is on fire right now, right? The lungs of the earth are being consumed and it seems like people don't care about that. Or maybe it's the political situation, right? And I'm not talking about our orange friend in the south, but I'm talking about things like our provincial government forming a committee on education that has no teachers on it. And so our kids are going to be taught something that teachers have no voice in. We might be wondering, what's going on? Doesn't anybody care about the future? What's happening? What's going to go on with our world? Maybe that's how you're seeing things be dismantled. But even in the middle of that, to think that somehow God's checked out, or God is angry and that's why this is happening or something, isn't the perspective to take. God is not obligated to restore. He doesn't ever have to. But God does. Because of God's character, because of his steadfast love, because of his unwavering commitment to be the one who loves the people that God has made, God is present. God hears. God will never let you go. And so I would encourage you to let the story of Jeremiah and the plight of Israel at this climactic event not be something to cause you to be distracted by, you know, I really don't like this idea that Israel got judged in that way or something like that. But to see instead that in the middle of all of this, God was always with them. And God is always with you. So don't ever let go of the God who will never let go of you. Amen.